treading on my poor memory right now.
House Judiciary Committee work session, February 8th, 1:30 p.m., room 354.
Committee will come to order. Clerk will note those members present. Representative Rutherford is excused. Balance are absent.
The chairman says show up for a vote.
House Bill 2252. Dennis?
Mr. Chairman, 2252 was heard on the 4th of February. This bill deals with appeals prior to the completion of all proceedings in actions or suits involving multiple parties and multiple claims. It is intended to settle all doubts as to what orders and judgments are appealable before the entire proceeding is finished. Subsections 1 and 2 are mechanical and introductory to Section 3. Section 3 is the heart of the bill. It breaks down into two components. Number 1, or first, if you have multiple parties or claims and it is appropriate to enter a final judgment or decree with respect to one or more, then number one, the court has to make an express determination that there is no just reason for further delay. And subsequent, number two, there has to be an express direction for the entry of the order or judge decree. So, second, within section three, if a final judgment or decree is ordered, the court may stay enforcement of the judgment or the decree, prescribe conditions to protect the party to be benefited eventually by the judgment or decree. 2252 is drawn from Federal Rule 54B, and it would repeal ORS 18.130, which at the present time allows the court in its discretion to render judgment against one or more defendants when a several judgment is proper, and leave the action to proceed against the remaining defendants. But that 18.130 wouldn't be necessary anymore if this bill was passed.
Is there a motion or any discussion on House Bill 2252?
Chairman?
Representative Lombard.
I would move that we approve House Bill 2253 with a deep pass recommendation for Bill B.
2252?
Excuse me, 52.
Yeah, that's my motion. All right, so discussion.
That recommendation would be in.
Diagonal here. All right, discussion on the motion to report the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Blumenauer?
Aye.
Representative Bugis?
Aye.
Representative Frommeyer?
Aye.
Representative Kulongoski?
Aye.
Representative Lombard?
Aye.
Representative Richards?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Chairman Myers?
Aye. Passed. House Bill 2253. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. I got my rotation worked out too well. I think I've been around once or twice already. Representative Lombard, would you take that bill?
Maybe I better learn to keep my mouth shut.
Yeah. Don't make any more motions.
No connection between the fact you made the motion.
Promise, Mr. Chairman.
Promise. I don't want to deter members from speaking out on the committee. 2253.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2253 was heard on February 4th. The bill deals with joinder of claims and would permit the plaintiff to join all claims he has against the defendant into one suit or action. The bill is derived from Federal Rule 18. It would repeal ORS 16.220, which now allows joinder by categories of claims. You should note that 16.305 now allows the defendant to join all counterclaims, regardless of category. Subsection 2 of the bill comes from ORS 16.220, subsection 1, paragraph small I, and is basically unchanged. Subsection 3 of the bill comes from subsection 2 of ORS 16.220, and also is basically unchanged. We have a proposed amendment to the text of the bill, which I'll pass out now.
Amendment stemming from the questioning in connection with the hearing on the bill would be on line 7 to, in order to make clear that we are not requiring only legal or only equitable claims, or permitting the joiner of only legal or only equitable, but of both, proposed amendment to delete or and substitute and after the word legal. Is there a motion for the adoption of that amendment? Representative Gardner so moves. Is there any discussion? Adopted. Further discussion on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chairman, as a matter of routine, are you going to ask for objection to the adoption?
Didn't I just say any objection to the amendment?
That was discussion. No, I didn't ask for the objection. There were objections. Very well. I'm sorry. I misheard what you said.
I thought I said, is there any objection to the amendment? And I perhaps should have said, is there any discussion? Is there discussion of the amendment?
Further discussion. Oh, of the amendment. I'm not
sure. Why was the point raised? Is there discussion on the amendment?
No,
I discussed the bill. I thought you said that. I thought we were on the bill. Right. The amendment.
Any discussion of the amendment? Any objection to the amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Richards.
I understood fundamentally that there was a difference between, in process, between legal and equitable action. And what I'm asking is if they can both be brought in the same suit, in the same court, in the same motion.
If this amendment, if this bill is passed as amended, or in fact as not, if not amended, but given its intention, claims could be joined, both legal and equitable claims could be joined in the same complaint. We now have an anomaly as a result of our action last session in which we permit that kind of joinder in counterclaims, but not in the initial complaint.
That's what I was wondering, if this was already established precedent. There was already that vehicle allowed. Thank you.
Discussion on the bill as amended. Representative Frohnmeyer.
I believe I asked this at the hearing, Mr. Chairman, but let me ask you again. We're substituting the word claim for the word cause of action. Does anyone think that that is going to be confusion in terminology? Change it.
Chair personally doesn't, but if there are other members who have a concern, certainly hear them.
Is there any fuzziness at all in members of the bar not being active? It confused me. I think I raised the question, but that's because I've been so long away from my
I think just from the discussion we've had already on the bill, particularly at the hearing, that it would be clear that the reference to claims is really a reference that aligns itself with the present concepts of causes of action and causes of suit in Oregon. And we are not, at this point, disturbing demurrer practice or motion practice, so that the adequacy of any claim or cause within a complaint will still be subject to attack by the usual methods.
Well, if you people don't feel it's any problem with practice, I sure won't raise the question.
I might say, too, the word claims is on occasion used in our present code as well as actions and suits, or causes of action rather than causes of suit. Further discussion on the bill as amended. Representative Frohnmeyer.
Move it to the floor with due pass.
Representative Frohnmeyer moves that the bill be reported to the floor with a due pass as amended. Any discussion on the motion? Representative Hume Gossett.
I've been reading George Jennings' letter to the Senator Brown, and I just talked to him. Change at 25-79. I understand that if both 52 and 53 go through together, the concern that he expressed in his letter will not arise. But he, if you read his letter, if one of them, if 52 doesn't go and only 53 goes, you're going to have a problem. 53
Why don't we defer action on 53 for a moment and go to 54 and see if there's going to be a problem in terms of sending both bills to the floor?
I'm not worried about that.
I think they're all going to go. I think he's worried about the Senate.
Yeah, I'm worried about the Senate passing one and not passing the other. And if Horner, I mean, if Jennings' concern in that letter is correct.
Well, I think what the bar is going to have to do is to follow these bills, as I'm sure they would, and keep making the Senate aware of that problem.
Do you have Mr. Horner's letter?
Yes, I do. And I don't know if
we had a broader, if we had a broader relating clause, we could join them both in one bill, and that would help ameliorate the problem. But I don't think we could get away with it.
There has been a subsequent piece of correspondence from Jennings too, joining out on the day of February 3rd.
Can this committee send a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee assuming it goes to Judiciary?
We could, in effect, second the concerns that have been raised. There's no objection we'll have Mr. Brown to do that, assuming the bill's passed the House. Assuming the bill's passed this committee. Further discussion on the bill as amended. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Blumenauer.
Aye.
Representative Bugis.
Aye.
Representative Frohnmeyer.
Aye.
Representative Kulongoski.
Aye.
Representative Lombard.
Aye.
Representative Richards.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Aye.
Chairman Meyer.
Aye. Approved. Let's see. Representative Kulongoski. No, I didn't remember who spoke last. Just who spoke most. House Bill 2254.
Mr. Chairman, 2254 was heard on February 4th. The bill deals with joinder of parties and would permit several plaintiffs or defendants to join in one action or suit where the same transaction or occurrence or common question of law or fact exists. Each potential party would not need to have an interest in the whole outcome of the case. Judgment with respect to any one party would be related to the party's right to relief or his respective liability. The court could protect the parties by orders or order separate trials. Also, defendants could be sued in the alternative, which is not possible under the present law. The bill is based on Federal Rule 20. It would repeal ORS 13.160, which now addresses joinder of parties but is not as comprehensive as this bill is. And we have a proposed amendment to this bill as well.
The amendment that's been distributed, I think it requires some further change, even if it's acceptable to the committee in concept, is the text of Federal Rule 21, which is captioned misjoinder and non-joinder of parties. All right, well, maybe it's unnecessary. Representative Richards?
Question of information, Mr. Chairman. Suing in the alternative in reference to Dennis's notes. Dennis could be sued in the alternative. Definition.
Representative Richards, may I read from the testimony of William C. Martin, came before the committee. The bill also addresses another problem with joinder. Under existing Oregon law, if a plaintiff is uncertain which of two defendants is responsible for the plaintiff's injuries, it is generally not possible to sue the defendant in the alternative. House Bill 2254 authorizes the assertion of claims against defendants in the alternative. I was summarizing the witness's testimony. When I wrote that out.
I still don't understand what that process is.
Look at the end. You can, under the text of the bill, have two defendants in the proceeding, and you allege that if one of those two people did it, and I'm suing them both, and they can both be in the same proceeding, and it's quite clear that you don't think they both did it, one or the other. You don't want to have either of them not a party to this proceeding. You want both in this proceeding. Let the trial process figure it out.
I see. All right. Thank you.
All right. Representative Blumenauer. Well, I had a drafted just for purposes of making sure we weren't missing an area that we need to consider, because a couple of lawyers talked with me about Federal Rule 21, and on examination of it further, I'm not sure it really adds anything. It may complicate matters, because it may just complicate matters. It may bump head on into some other provision that we haven't analyzed. So at this point, my suggestion would be that it not be considered. Further discussion on House Bill 2254.
Is the amendment, Mr. Chairman, then not offered, you withdraw?
Well, I'm not offering it. I just
say, and it's unnecessary in the opinion.
I think that's the consensus that I gave right now. Further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richards.
Just a question again. Is the basic purpose behind it to eliminate actions that could be heard at the same time to help the docket?
I think the purpose of this would be to maximize the flexibility of joinder of parties in a single lawsuit, and reduce the necessity for multiple actions against parties. Now, they may be tried separately within a given lawsuit, depending on the circumstances of the case, but they can be, in terms of the pleadings, they can be combined in a single paper, in a single filing with a court.
Thank you.
Further discussion? A motion on 2254. You've already been appointed to carry a bill.
It's like an inoculation. I thought I was out of it. I didn't.
Representative Kulin, is your motion to report it through pass?
Yes.
Representative Kulongoski moves that House Bill 2254 be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation. discussion on the motion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Blumenauer?
Aye.
Representative Bieber?
Aye.
Representative Cronemeyer? Representative Kulongoski?
Aye.
Representative Lombard?
Aye.
Representative Richards?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Chairman Myers?
Aye. Representative Gardner, will you carry that bill? Representative Cronemeyer is excused for purposes of recordation votes. 2255.
Chairman, House Bill 2255 was heard on the 4th of February. The bill amends ORS 17.320. It would eliminate one category of materials which the jury may take with them into the jury deliberation room. That category is pleading. The purpose of the bill is to reduce extensive and expensive, quote, motion practice, close quote, in which attorneys must appear before the court to get the opposing side to amend its pleading so that the final form of the pleading, which may now go to the jury room, is not unjustifiably damaging to their clients. If the pleadings didn't go to the jury room, neither side would try as hard to put damaging statements into its pleadings or to eliminate damaging statements from the other's pleadings, or at least this is the argument in support of the bill. And this bill has a proposed amendment.
The first part of the amendment that's been distributed attempts to follow up on the suggestion of Judge Behe that elimination of the pleadings be accompanied by an authorization to the court to submit an impartial written statement of the issues. We'll come back to the wording of that in a moment. The other two portions of the amendment were prepared at my suggestion by Dennis to dovetail this new device, if it were approved by the committee, into the statutes that govern how exceptions are taken at trial to certain actions of the court, and to put the statement of issues on the same footing with jury instructions, such that if an exception were not taken at trial to the statement of issues, there could be no claim of error on appeal. In other words, the court would have to be informed at the time of trial and given an opportunity to correct its action. Otherwise, the parties would waive any error in the statement as a ground for review on appeal. So, 17.505 and 17.510, those portions of this total amendment would be designed to accomplish that change.
Move the amendment.
Okay, why don't you hold that motion just a moment, Ted. Let me come back to the first part, which is based on the suggestion by Judge Beatty. Now, as it's stated here, it says the court may, in its discretion, submit to the jury an impartial written statement of the issues, it says, presented in the trial. And I don't know whether that is better than to say to be decided by the jury. Well, no, they would have to be. I'm not saying that other language.
Issues to be decided by the jury. Those
Gardner?
It seems to me that the language presented in the trial is maybe a little too broad. I would think that to be decided by the jury would better conform to Judge Beatty's suggestion, and would basically eliminate the possibility of perhaps that one judge in a thousand that would put something into the statement that would basically be irrelevant, that might be subject to reversal on appeal. For that reason, I would move to amend the amendment to state at the end of line 63, quote, the court may, in its discretion, submit to the jury an impartial written statement of the issues to be decided by the jury.
Okay, to simplify things, Ted, could we call for your motion as to the whole thing with that change included? All right. Representative Bugis moves the amendment distributed with the change to be decided by the jury in place of the words presented in the trial in the first portion of the amendment. And that would be part of an insertion at the end of line 6 of the bill. I think in the form it would read other than depositions, period, and we have a new sentence entirely. Is that discussion on the amendment?
Right.
Representative Lombard.
In the hearing yesterday on this matter and work session today, I called a number of attorneys in the trial bar just to try to get a broader idea of what their feelings were, and none of them had any objection to the original bill. Some of them did have some reservations, however, about the submission by the court submitting this impartial written statement, particularly in leaving it in the court's description. One of the trial lawyers told me that, for instance, that parties do have available today the right to request that the court submit written instructions to the jury. And although it is, I gather, seldom exercised, that authority is there. I really don't, personally don't have any strong feelings one way or the other about this. I should report my conversation, and I must say I think they're primarily from members of the defense bar that I was able to get a hold of today. We might want to consider, instead of granting this authority solely to the discretion of the court to submit the statement of issues, maybe to grant the authority to the court upon application by either application of hearing by either of the parties. Throw that out as an alternative mechanism for getting that statement, for having it prepared for getting it to the jury.
Representative Kiliowski.
My concern is probably goes on the same issue as Kip's, but I want to arrive at a different result because I do not see that the proposal that Judge Beatty made and the idea behind it should ever rise to the level of instruction to the jury, and or someone mandating the court to issue the statement. I guess in a practical matter, how I would see it operate is that if both of the parties agree to the statement of issues that the judge has submitted, if one accepted, had no exception, but I don't think that the judge would submit the issue. I think they just say, fine, both can't agree, and I'm not going to get very hassle because the judge, I think, the trial judge, is reluctant to create another issue about which one of the parties can go up on appeal. And if it rises to the magnitude of an instruction, I'm concerned that what you've done is given one more element for an appeal, which I think would be just crowding the docket to see further on appeal. So I voiced an exception originally to the idea of even having a statement at all, which everyone agrees with. I would like to see it, but as proposed by, as a matter of fact, Representative Gardner's motion.
You need to inform me now, huh?
Yeah, we have it right now.
Representative Gardner?
It seems to me that the benefits that could be derived from this are substantial. I think it's a matter of practical application that the position that Ted takes would be the prevailing one, if the judge would not give an instruction to one or both the attorneys did not want to give. There have been cases where I've been a defense attorney where I probably wouldn't have wanted something like this for the very reason that I only hope to win the case was to confuse the jury. But notwithstanding that, I think it's probably a good amendment, and I think it would work well in practice.
Representative Lombard, I think the concern, phrased another way, some of the attorneys is that they see in the federal system that the judges have taken over so much of the trial. And somebody said the other day it's become a paper trial, all the way from jury selection to commenting on the evidence and so forth. And I suspect that one of their fears is that when you give the court the sole discretion to submit an impartial written statement of the issues, that in effect is giving the judge another controlling tool over the conduct of the trial. And, in an indirect way, might allow the judge to influence the issues the way it's, say an impartial written statement of the issues. But, we all know here that no matter you can change a word or two and lose your impartiality on statements of issues.
Do you wish to move a further amendment to this, Representative Lombard?
No, I don't really have any answer. I'm expressing this viewpoint. If nobody else, is concerned about it, I don't have really strong.
Well, as I understand your comments, you would like, or some of those you've talked to at least, would like to see the one of the parties trigger this vehicle by a request.
Yeah.
So it might read something like the court may, in its discretion, and upon the request of it. Representative Fielandowski.
I misunderstood what you. I thought you were getting at the issue that if one of the parties wanted a statement of issue, that he could compel the court to give a statement of issue. That's what I thought your motion was going to.
If it's requested, it's still discretionary to the court.
It would still be discretionary. Yeah, I think your feeling was
the court can't do it on its own initiative. So.
That's right. It simply would take out the fact that the court could not do it on its own initiative, but that it would have to be triggered by the request.
Well, is there a motion to that effect by way of a trigger? There is no motion. Well, it would be to add language that would require.
Court
in its discretion and upon the request of any party.
Or upon the request.
Well, not or. It depends on whether the court is to have the power to do it on its own initiative or whether one of the parties must ask for it.
Well, doesn't they, Mr. Chairman, give the court discretionary power? The court may upon motion of a party. Wouldn't that cover all your
Yes.
The court may, which is discretionary, upon the motion of a party, submit the jury. But he wants on the motion of both parties.
No, I understand. One party.
None of them were really too clear in terms of specifics. They didn't have the bill before them.
Is there a motion with respect to this concept? Further discussion on the proposed amendment? Representative Richards?
Chairman, absent pleading. And the initiative of either the court or a moving party for a statement of issues. What is available to the jury for its deliberation?
Well, it will receive instructions, either orally or in writing, we'll know.
Mm-hmm.
And it will receive the exhibits, received in evidence, other than depositions. So,
records or private documents have been received in evidence of court may in its discretion, and were so doing, the letter with the Administration of Justice to make copies of such papers to the jury for consideration, returning the originals to those entitled to their possession. I think that's really a sub part of the exhibits portion of this. They may also take with them notes of the testimony or other proceedings taken by themselves or any of them, but none taken by any other person. Sitting there taking notes, they can carry those in.
So that no interpretation of what those exhibits.
This section has been, I think, administered without any particular difficulty for some long period of time.
Okay.
The only thing we're pulling out is the
But I see. Okay.
Just a short comment to you, Sandy. Just from personal experience, there are a lot of times I think that, well, the biggest problem I think is sometimes the jury just gets very confused. You sit there and there's 25 minutes of instructions, and they can be repeated, but the judge is very unwilling on a lot of occasions to repeat the instructions after they started deliberating. So they get this big run through of 25 minutes of these instructions, which are framed in legalese. And they get the exhibits, and they get the pleadings, and they go on all this. Sometimes I have a feeling it's kind of a crapshoot, just to see, you know, who's going to win or what's going to happen. And I think that if they had an impartial statement of the issues that they have to consider, that we'd probably get more reasoned jury verdicts. That's why I think it's a good one.
Thank
you. Chairman. Representative Lombard.
I will propose an amendment.
B, to delete the phrase "in its discretion," which appears in the first line of the second paragraph of the first amendment, and to insert in lieu of that the phrase "at the request of one of the parties."
Any party be
of any.
Representative Lombard moves that the amendment be amended by deleting the words "in its discretion" and substituting "at the request of any party." Discussion on the amendment to the amendment. Representative Gardner.
I would take it that your position would be, Representative Lombard, that the word "may" would give the court discretion to deny the request of the party requesting the proposed statement.
I think that, yes, I think that with the word "may" in there, that implicitly carries with it the discretionary power of the court, but it would simply require that the procedure of submitting the statement would be initiated by one of the parties rather than initiated by the judge.
To the amendment,
Representative Gardner.
It seems to me that one of the problems I can see with your approach is that you may get into a situation where there's some game playing, or at least the appearance of some game playing on the part of one of the counsels in requesting the written statement to go to the jury. If the district attorney says, "I'd like to have a written statement of the issue," I, as a defense attorney, say, "Why is he asking for that? Why does he want that?" And I think there might be more hassle, more time spent arguing over A, whether to do it, and B, what form it would take, if it came at the request of one of the parties, rather than having it come just from the judge as a matter of clarification of the issues to the jury. I have a lot less trouble with something that the judge proposes than I do something that the opposing counsel proposes, because he happens to be an advocate. That's just a feeling I would express.
Representative Lombard.
Well, I see the safety factor, again, still being in the court, in the discretion.
just, it seems to me that it's still, from a trial tactic and conduct of the trial standpoint, it just leaves the initiation of it in the hands of counsel. And if both counsels do not want submission of the statement of the issues for whatever reason, then I feel that ought to be the prerogative of both counsels. And I think in that kind of situation, you know, if the sole discretion is left in the hands of the court for that, I'd submit the statement of issues when neither party wants, when neither counsel feels it's either necessary or desirable.
Bill, one question. Do you think that both the attorneys have the, should have the power to basically take a chance gambling that if there is some confusion, assuming that there might be a case where there might be some confusion in the case, and they would both of them have to take their chances with that rather than attempting to clarify the issue if the judge thought that was necessary?
Well, I think you've got a difference of opinion, you know. You're always going to have a difference of opinion, particularly on what the issues are. You know, I could perceive a situation in which neither counsel would define the issues exactly the way the court is going to define the issues. And I don't see that the court, you know, of necessity has any greater clairvoyance than the parties. It's not a necessity, right? It's in most cases.
But in any case, if you put it in the way that it is presently, the court is going to be the one that's going to be deciding.
That's right. Yeah. You're right. And I misspoke myself in that sense. The court is still going to decide. It's just, I guess, who's going to initiate that decision? Who's going to initiate the decision to submit the written statement? And should it be solely in the hands of the court? Or should counsel be in the hands of counsel? My feeling is that I'd be in the hands of counsel to initiate the request.
One last.
Representative Gardner.
How would you feel if it was either? Some language like the court may, in its discretion, or at the request of one of the parties. Does that make you feel better?
Not a lot better.
Further discussion on the amendment to the amendment. Question is on the amendment to the amendment, which is to substitute the words after request of any party for the words in its discretion as part of the insertion to be made at the end of line 6. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Blumenau.
Aye.
Representative Dugas.
Aye.
Representative Kulongoski.
Aye.
Representative Lombard.
Aye.
Representative Richards.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Nay.
Chairman Meyer.
No. Passed. Further discussion on the amendment as amended. Question is on the amendment as amended. Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment as amended? Adopted. Further discussion on the bill as amended. Is there a motion on the bill as amended? Was there a motion previously? No, I don't believe it was. I don't think so. Is there a motion on the bill as amended?
I would move that we send House Bill 2255 as amended.
Representative Blumenauer moves that we send House Bill 2255 to the floor for the due pass recommendation as amended. And would you include in that it's engrossed? Yeah, engrossed.
No.
Yeah, I take that as part of the motion.
Yes.
Further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Blumenau.
Aye.
Representative Kulongoski.
Aye.
Representative Lombard.
Aye.
Representative Richards.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Aye.
Chairman Meyer.
Aye. Pass. Representative Richards, would you carry that bill?
Try.
Okay, 2250.
Well, you see some of the questions we worked up for you, Steve.
Oh, you're right.
2256. Rumpka?
Mr. Chairman, 2256 was heard on the 4th of February. The bill deals with verification of pleadings. It would eliminate verification, that is, the requirement that a party or his attorney sign a statement before a notary that the contents of the document are verified or true. Instead, the pleading would be sufficient if it were subscribed, that is, the signature at the bottom would mean that the subscriber had read the pleading, believed the contents to be supportable on good grounds, and that the pleading was not a device for harassment or delay. The bill is taken from Federal Rule Law 11. Sections 2, 3, and 4 are mechanical. Form repeals 16.080, which omits the requirement of verification of an answer if an answer to an allegation in the pleading might subject the answering party to prosecution for a felony. And it would be needed if there were no verification.
Representative Illinois.
I move in the House Bill 2256 to fulfill the due process recommendation.
Representative Blumenauer moves that we send House Bill 2256 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Representative Lombard.
And again, in my survey, I found no opposition to this. Neither can I find any support for what I was going to do.
Agnosticism, that's what you're talking about.
No, you didn't let me finish. It was support for what I was going to offer and entitle as the Bugis Amendment. Those of you who overheard it in the public hearing the other day, that perhaps what we should do is require a false swearing affidavit with Class A misdemeanor penalties. There's some discussion that might cut down considerably on number of complaints cases filed and might solve some of the problems of malpractice and all of that. Since there was no support for that.
Further discussion on the motion.
That you didn't find any lawyers that doubted the veracity of lawyers.
No, that wasn't the issue. No guts.
Further discussion on the motion. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Blumenauer.
Aye.
Representative Kulongoski.
Aye.
Representative Lombard.
Aye.
Representative Richards.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Aye.
Chairman Myers.
Aye. Representative Blumenauer, will you carry that?
Chairman, this passes. One of our friends, Senator Secretary, has gone to the lawyers as soon as they got an order sheet.
House Bill 2257. I might say, if there's no objection on the part of the committee, what I'd like to do on the three discovery bills, 7, 58, 59, unless there's a test vote called for on an outright tabling of any of them, that we would proceed to them one by one and elicit instructions from the committee for drafting of amendments. I think a number of different amendments were suggested in the hearings which the committee might like to have pursued. And we bring those three bills back for our next work session next week. I think we can. I have a number of notes. I think Dennis does, but I think we got to give him guidance, and we can get the amendments in written form. And let's take guard 2257.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Can I ask you a clarification? You suggest that all three of those discovery bills be amended and then brought back to us.
Well, I am only suggesting that unless there's readiness on the part of the committee to act on any one of them in its present form, that we might best proceed by getting committee members to suggest amendments they like prepared. I think from my notes there may be proposals as to each one of those three, but that's only a suggestion. Chair will entertain a motion if any of these bills at this meeting, but
well, I would.
There were a number of suggestions made, I think, and some as to all of them.
I don't know the. Would you accept a motion to act on 57?
Well, let's take Mr. Rompkin's comments first, and then I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to House Bills 2257 and 2258, I didn't prepare an extensive summary, because the more I got into summarizing, it seemed that summarizing was pointless. You'd have to go through it section by section, but I do have some notes. House Bill 2257 was heard on the 7th of February. It deals with the topic of interrogatories and allows up to 25 written interrogatories and more upon a court order. It's based upon Federal Rule 33, and it's my perception that it would probably be best for the committee to go through the bill in depth without further summary, but I will advert to some of the suggested amendments. On page 2, line 5, there was a question of that was raised about the use of the word proceeding, especially as it might apply to a proceeding before, in the workman's compensation area. Also, on page 4, line 14, after the word party, there was a suggestion that the word or a witness be inserted. So it would read a party or a witness. And other than that, I don't have any indication of suggested amendments, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were some.
And what was that? Party or a witness?
Party or a witness. Page 4, line 14.
I was asked to address the problem that Laird Patrick brought up about ORS 45-181, protection of witnesses. My notes.
I have a couple, too, that I'd like to point out. Line, first of all, hold on, maybe I better stop back for a moment. What was the nature of your motion?
Table.
Well, let's take that now and find out.
Motion
one.
Move table. 22.
Representative Bugis moves that House Bill 2257 be tabled. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Blumenauer. Representative Bugis.
Aye.
Representative Frommeyer.
No.
Representative Kulongoski.
No.
Representative Lombard.
No.
Representative Richards.
No.
Representative Gardner.
No.
Chairman Meyer.
No.
That was very popular.
Only one way to test the water. Jump in.
It would have saved a lot of work, you guys.
This reference, the inclusion of so-called proceedings within the ambit of the bill was a question that was raised. I think that's been mentioned, but that language recurs in more than one place. So if it's the committee's desire to have for consideration amendments to delete the reference to proceedings, we want to have Dennis scrutinize the bill carefully to pick up every reference to it.
Who raised that issue?
Norton Scott Board.
Yeah.
I would be concerned if that is going to have the application to all the administrative proceedings.
All right, well, that concern has been noted, and Dennis will prepare appropriate amendments for committee consideration. The second point that I had noted from I thought we had, according to our more rigorous procedure, we would actually get the language in front of us and act on it. Line-by-line basis. Representative Richards?
As I recall, Representative Rutherford raised the point that mandamus and one other court proceeding might be excluded from the provisions of discovery that this bill addresses if you didn't, instead of dropping the word proceeding, add the word court.
The word may have been, I'm not sure it was court or special. Why don't we have Dennis check that? Because that's a good point. We don't want to eliminate those kinds of proceedings.
We're being sued in federal court and we're going to do that stuff anyway.
For my unemployment claims.
Chairman, is your instruction then to insert the word court proceeding or or to try to determine which one would be better, court or special, and take the better of those two words and insert that rather than delete the words or proceeding?
Right. As I understand it, the directive would be to develop language that would clearly exclude or clearly confine the availability of interrogatories to proceedings in court in the sense of those initial or original kinds of proceedings, excluding administrative proceedings. I'm sorry, Representative Gardner.
Just a question. I maybe wasn't listening as close as I could. What are the policy considerations besides lack of counsel that would mitigate us towards taking a position that should have interrogatories in any proceeding?
I suppose the other members of the committee are speaking for themselves. For myself, I think it's more a matter of just sort of step at a time approach to the new vehicle.
What was his question? What was the objection of the administrative agency? Well, they objected to the guy having to handle the problem of interrogatories being demanded without the benefit of counsel. That was the basis upon which the workman's comp man objected. Said the man stands up there and is with some of his first stage and he's got no counsel, but he's going through early stages of an administrative hearing and somebody's under this he thinks could submit interrogatories and confuse the guy and he doesn't end up.
Let me state my position this way. This bill and the two companions are really intended to be elements of civil procedure in court. Now that doesn't mean they can't be expanded, but I think we'd probably be, I'm not sure he wouldn't be a little precipitous without some rather extensive testimony on the question of administrative agencies to extend the bill that far, this bill. I'm not saying that vehicle shouldn't ultimately be available in administrative proceedings, and the committee may wish to do that in this bill, but I conceive of these three companion bills as part of the code of court procedure. Representative Richard?
Chairman, would interrogatories be used as a less expensive method to a client in the preparation of a case as opposed to deposition if this legislation passes?
I think the answer would be sometimes yes, sometimes no. No, I'm not trying to dodge your question, but I think the legal aid situation, for example, might be one in which interrogatories would provide a truly alternate vehicle to depositions, in terms of the discovery initiated by the plaintiff or whichever party is represented by the individual. In most cases with which I've been personally involved, interrogatories supplement rather than replace depositions.
Become another step in the process.
Right. And they are a means of developing. They can be, let's put it this way, a means of developing a lot of basic kind of information, which is used as a springboard for further discovery in the case. Might sue corporations and ask, you know, the names of all their directors and officers through years and shareholders and so forth. Accumulate information of that kind.
What would the additional cost be to a client for serving 25 interrogatories? Could you, is that something you could?
It's a contingent fee case, none.
Okay.
Unless there's some out of pocket expense connected with copying documents or something like that, copying copies of the interrogatories themselves or something of that sort. But, in a fee basis case, an hourly basis case,
knowing that the legal services that they receive from those law review office, I think the
not present during the testimony on this.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, don't you remember Mr. Green, Mr. Cooney, now Green, plaintiff's attorney, and of course is on a contingent fee nearly all the time. And he said it would be more expensive to him, wouldn't save time, would not eliminate depositions, and would be much more expensive to the attorney. Now, if the client, you might not bleed for a contingent fee attorney, let's say, but if the client were paying for that on the basis of hours spent, he made kind of a compelling case to me for a lot of additional costs. And if you get into the case where you've got the public defender, or the case where the attorney's general defense for the state, then I think you get into this huge cost, additional cost of interrogatory being kind of an integral part of the case. It looks to me like it would be a lot of cost. I agree with Tim. I think if you get into a contest, or I think it was Cooney here, according to my notes, who said you get into a contest of legal writing. And it seems to me like you detract from the facility of the legal procedure to solve a question rather than aid it.
Well,
three, not moved to table. I'm a little surprised that you're practicing lawyer bought it so completely. I thought there was a general feeling in the hearing that the practicing attorneys experienced in this didn't like this one at all.
Well, I've got a fair amount of experience in federal practice, and I think that
you don't feel.
I think
it's
completely
wrong. Well, that's fair enough.
There's a sharp disagreement
I just
about it among those who
yeah,
have experience.
I didn't realize that.
My telephone call, and there was a sharp disagreement. On
really?
It among defense counsel, for instance, and I think this was represented the other day. I don't think the plaintiff's counsel likes it particularly because it's their time.
They're 100%.
100% their time and not their, in most instances, and not their
client. Well, again, that's what Green said. He said the defense that he felt would be split on it.
Well, part of the reason the defense was split in there, you know, is the safeguards in general. And I was really speaking in part of the bill. Safeguards in here are limitation of the number that are operating and in the sanctions if the procedure is abused. They, however, did agree almost unanimously that in federal court everybody felt the procedure was being abused or horribly abused.
Well, where you have a limited access to this vehicle, there is a line that can be crossed where they can become a weapon, as somebody said, for just punishing an individual for being in the litigation in the first place. And if you've got a big corporation that's willing to pour in the dough, you know, they can really ladle them out. And but I personally think that they are a useful vehicle, and if a limitation in here, we won't know unless and if it's tried, but I really think that limitation in number will be very corrective in that respect. Well, if there's a request for an amendment to be prepared with respect to a different number, Dennis will take that and bring it back to us for consideration. No objection. I just assume not vote on amendments today, but we'll accede to the wishes or requests of any member as far as preparation of amendments.
I have the figure 20 just to make that there's only one individual in there.
I had thought perhaps about a smaller number. I have to say that, first of all, I received my education in connection with federal rules, and I thought written interrogatories were part of life, and when I started practicing and found they weren't, I was very surprised, and I've also thought they'd be a useful tool. I did see, however, yesterday some problems in connection with it, and I received last night from my partner, who apparently numerous, had this bill under consideration, a big packet of interrogatories that he received. Because of that, I thought maybe the appropriate thing to do would be to have a fewer number
give the bar some opportunity to use some space. That way, I could see in smaller types of litigation where they would have some use of it. I talked with the legal aid attorney, Francis Mason, made a good point that they would be useful in his case. I'd also assure you that for smaller cases, particularly if you were a plaintiff's lawyer, the number of interrogatories could have a distinct influence on whether or not you were even willing to take such cases. Those were just things that ran through my mind, and I thought maybe the better way to do it was to ease into it. I just threw that out for discussion, and I know it was other people on the committee have a strong point of view on it.
Well, we can all be pondering that. I don't know that a written amendment as to the number has to be proposed or brought in by Dennis. When we come back to that line in the bill, we'll take up any motions there are on it. And,
I just thought it was
no, I appreciate your comments. I think they're right along the line we were concerned about. There was some concern raised also in line 21 as to the fact that court alone has control over the length of time, and there was a suggestion that that provision be expanded to permit the parties themselves by stipulation to extend the time for answering. I don't know that we need to make a lot of comment on it at this point. Dennis, you might prepare an appropriate amendment along that line. We can pick that up when we get into the bill later. Representative Richards?
Could one of you give me an example under which it would be appropriate to both parties' interests for less than 30 days to be allowed? I don't understand the purpose for shorter or longer time.
Well, let's see. I've never had any experience with interrogatories in which a lesser time was requested and ordered. And, I don't, you might have a situation in which, you might have a, well, one possibility might be this, you might have a trial in February, and your local court rules might not impinge on the freedom of the parties to submit interrogatories at that stage without the court's approval. And perhaps the interrogatory is a very simple one, or two or three. Could be answered in much less time. The party might request the court to track that time in order to provide the answers sooner for ultimate use.
Is there any remedy for someone appearing before the court if they feel that that shorter time is not adequate?
The party requests an additional period of time. Normally that's done by agreement. That is, upon the court's approval. Federal court, the parties do not have the prerogative of extending periods of time for doing anything without the court's approval. State courts could be more relaxed about this. Normally what happens in federal court is the parties will reach an agreement between themselves, prepare a written stipulation for an order that extends the time so many days, and then that's submitted to the court and signed as an order. Or to the clerk. The clerk may have the authority in the federal rules for a first extension of time when answering.
I can think of an example in my own practice in federal court where they moved for an order shortening time to answer interrogatories because the witness was coming from out of town for deposition, and they wanted the answers to the interrogatories prior to deposing the witness so that they would have complete background on the required information in order to conduct an intelligible deposition. So I've seen it done in that context.
I have too. I would
thank
you.
Okay, further comments on Section 1, Section 2, Section 3, the inclusion of witness, I think, has been noted already. The Dennis will prepare an appropriate amendment there.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Frohman.
Is there any need to include witness if interrogatories are not served on a witness? Pursuant to this whole bill. I remember I raised the question, and then as we looked at it, it appeared that interrogatories can be served only on parties.
Well, I don't, it seems to me this section is intended to be the, aren't we repealing? We're repealing the section relating to to protection, which relates to...
Now that I look at this, this would refer to any discovery. It says reference to discovery. So this would be broader than written interrogatories. It would be protective orders with respect to all discovery devices. Okay.
Right. And that's why I think the witness acceded to that point is a good one.
Okay. All right. I agree with
overly
you.
Narrowed given
I agree
the scope of the section. Oh, if I could double... committee back for a moment to page 2, line 13. It says, or line 12, the number of interrogatories that may be served by any party upon an opposing party. Now, I don't know whether, and that's an insertion that the committee made, that doesn't appear in the federal rules. It just says, you know, federal rules say any other party or something to that effect. And I'm not sure that, practical matter, you wouldn't normally be serving interrogatories other than opposing parties, but I suppose it's conceivable there could be a co-plaintiff or a co-defendant that you might want to be able to serve.
You might want to, for instance, serve them on a co-defendant before deciding whether to file a cross-claim.
Yeah. So I think that amendment ought to be proposed to change that for consideration by the committee.
So that it would say upon any opposing party, then?
That's what it says now. It would just say upon
any
probably
party.
Any other party. Section 4, scope of discovery. Section 5, section 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Dennis has those instructions. If any of you, upon further review of the bill, have additional amendments you want prepared for consideration, feel free to just contact Dennis directly and request these.
Okay, Dennis, could you look at the letter that Professor Lacey sent with respect to his question? And then maybe double check them with Professor Patrick, because I believe they disagree with each other. The advisability of some of the changes. I'd simply like you to brief me on what the deed is about.
2258. Oh, I'm sorry. It's 5 minutes to three. Why don't we take a 5 minute recess? Is that agreeable with me? Many will. Under order, House Bill 2258.
House Bill 2258 was heard on the 7th of February. The bill deals with admissions of truth of fact as well as the genuineness of documents or objects, which is now dealt with in ORS 41.625. The bill is derived from Federal Rule 36. And it's my opinion that it would be best for the committee to consider the bill without further summary. But there are some further points of consideration that the bill, that the committee might keep in mind as it goes through it. On page 2, line 6, a question was raised as to the use of the word proceeding, and I think that we've already dealt with that. I'll prepare amendments accordingly. And on line 14, the word deemed admitted, and it proposal for an admission of the truth of facts is deemed admitted if it is not answered or objected to. There was a comment raised that Federal Rule 36B empowers the court to allow withdrawal of admission by silence, and that concept might be fruitful for a proposed amendment to the bill.
There are two approaches, I think, at least that we've had before us. One is to incorporate that approach and in effect leave it to the initiative of the defaulting party to seek relief from the default in answering, the effect of the default in answering. or to incorporate some kind of tickler on the part of the attorney serving the interrogatory or the request for admission.
5-day reminder before final, before admission is final, is kind of the way that we got from one witness.
Maybe the simplest way to do it would be to ask Dennis to prepare alternative amendments, and rather than take a great deal of time now discussing it, just get some specific language before us from which we can make a choice. That's agreeable to the committee. Representative Frohnmeyer?
One other concern I raised yesterday is that we have departed from the federal rule by using the word fact rather than the word matter. And if you'll notice, actually, our own draft here is inconsistent, because in line 8, you'll see it refers to relevant facts, but then in line 14, it refers to the matter. And I think we ought to be consistent one way or the other.
I was thinking that one of the reasons, it's been a long time since I've studied federal rules, but one of the reasons that they stay away from the word fact is because of the difficulty of defining it.
Any objection on the part of the committee to an amendment that would align that usage, the concept matter throughout?
Chairman, I would like to ask Dennis simply to follow up with Professor Patrick to see if he's been able to determine why the committee changed it. My preference would be for matter, but if they had a good reason, I think we ought to consider that at the same time.
Right, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lombard.
Dave, in looking at reference to the word matter, line 14, I see that is more of a generic term, all-encompassing, including both facts as well as genuineness of relevant documents or physical objects.
Well, that may be that the word matter is used in line 19.
And in line 32.
So, I guess about all I'd say is I think it is a, it's a problem that, as you say, you have Dennis look into and check there and make sure that it's consistent in our syntax and also in cross-referencing.
Dennis, you might also check federal rules decisions and see if there aren't some fairly concise interpretations of matter as used in Rule 36 as far as requests for admissions on fact type matters. Because that body of law would become precedent for the interpretation of this section, at least authority for it.
Matters seem to be used quite generally too. On page 3, it's on line 5 and 12 also. Just glancing quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. This brings me back to a point. As I look at the rule now that I think I mentioned yesterday, the rule says a party may serve upon any other party a written request for the admission, for purposes of the pending action only, of the truth of any matters within the scope of Rule 26B. Now, that's the scope of discovery rule. It plugs back into that. That's been deleted here. Perhaps you ought to prepare an amendment that would bring the reference back to the... Well, that's right. And we were talking about adding to this bill a section which would recapitulate that scope of discovery as it's set forth in the other bills, and then make an interrelationship within this bill of that section.
Could you give me that, this point out where, what page?
Rule 36, 59. In the scope of Rule 26B. Within the scope of Section 4 of this Act, Section 3 of this Act, bring forward the scope of discovery section and then put it in the other bills. Okay, further requests for drafting of amendments?
Chairman?
Representative Richards?
I only want to note for any committee members' reaction, one witness yesterday who raised lines 29 and 30 as a little bit too restrictive. An answering party may not give lack of information or knowledge as a reason for failure to admit. And I don't know by comparison, what import that has, but I only raise it as I underlined it and remember that a witness raised it yesterday.
Tom Quinney raised that. That was too severe.
The effect, as I have always understood it, the effect of that part of the federal rule, Sandy, is to place on the party served an obligation to make some effort to respond rather than being able to say, according to my present state of knowledge, without regard to what I could find out, I can't respond. It's up to the committee to decide whether you want to change that burden or not. My inclination is to say that without that kind of provision, you can get a lot of fooling around. A lot of people who can avoid the real thrust of the requests without undertaking even reasonable effort to respond.
What is the course of action available if there is not information available, or if there's a portion of the request that can't be responded to under the grounds genuinely?
Well, what does the party do?
Mm-hmm.
The party responds by indicating an inability to answer because of
okay. A
lack of knowledge.
The other side objects. Then we'll go have a hearing on it.
Sometimes. Further requests for amendments to 2258. All right, 2259. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lombard.
Survey, there will be no objection.
Let me take Dennis's comments first. Get them in there.
Mr. Chairman, 2259 was heard by the committee on February 7th. The bill deals with production of documents and related matters. Under the existing procedure, ORS 41.615, a prior court order is required, but under this bill, the party would first request the production of documents, and only if the request were refused or ignored would he need a court order. I'm going to read the full text of what I thought was a good summary from Mr. Kilpatrick. 2259 is based on the amended version of Federal Rule 34 and Section 2 of House Bill 3013, which was introduced last legislature. There are two significant differences between Federal Rule 34 and 2259. One, the federal rule defines documents to include writings, drawings, drafts, charts, photographs, phonograph records, and other data compilations from which information can be obtained, translated if necessary, by the respondent through detection devices into a reasonably usable form. House Bill 2259 does not contain this definition. And second, the Federal Rule 34B requires the party upon whom a request is served to file a written response, either objecting or stating that the inspection will be permitted as requested. The House bill that we're considering now allows compliance with the request as sufficient without requiring an advance statement that the request will be honored. The procedures for compelling compliance with a request and penalties for noncompliance with a court order are specified in Section 3. Procedures for protecting a party upon whom a request for discovery was made from annoyance, embarrassment, oppression, or undue burden or expense are specified in Section 4, and that Section 4 is taken from Federal Rule 26C. For purposes of uniformity, ORS 45.181, the statute protecting against abuse or hardship in depositions, is repealed. Section 5 of the proposed legislation defines the permissible scope of discovery, and Oregon has no statute like this at the current time. That's taken from Federal Rule 26B1. Sections 7 through 12 are mechanical. And in addition to any other amendments you might choose to make, it was suggested that on page 2, line 24, the comma, that's presently in that line be deleted and reinserted after the word objection. That's tiny mechanical amendment. You may have others.
Well, the or proceeding language was again an issue in this bill. So you might prepare appropriate amendments there. Let's take it section by section. Section 2, were there any further amendments requested as to Section 2?
Mr. Chairman, I know that Dennis has brought to our attention that this portion of Rule 34, which is in the parentheses regarding writings, drawing, draft charts, is not in the Hospital 2259. I don't know that it's necessary that we put them in if we indicate that we are desired, but that by excluding them, leaving them out of 2259, we do not intend to exclude them from this coverage.
Did Larry comment or anyone comment why they were left out of 2259?
I don't recall him saying anything about it. The language does seem broad enough to cover most of the documents or tangible things. But there is always a possibility of interpretation by leaving them out, specifically when intended to exclude them.
Why don't you check with Laird on that point, Dennis? And why don't you prepare an amendment reincorporating that language for our consideration without regard to whether we accept it or not? That'll be something we decide later, and you can report back to us on Laird's comments about the reasons for that omission.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lombard.
I just was glancing here at 41615 that we would be repealing just to see what generic terms we use, and the language there is any designated documents, papers, books, accounts, letters, photographs, objects, or tangible things not privileged, etc. And I would just suggest that we've probably got a body of case law in the state interpreting these items, and we should probably look to whether we are going to be broadening that. That would be except the federal rule definition.
One alternative amendment?
I guess I'm just raising a question at this point. I don't know. I assume that the federal rule is much broader.
Well, why don't you check with Larry and find out why that language was omitted, and perhaps give us an assessment also of where the language we're adopting, if we didn't make any changes, how that would make it, say, present law. This one. We've got three different versions floating around here, present law, this bill, and the federal rule. Also, if we go back to Section 2 for just a moment, I raised the point yesterday that subsection 4 of Section 2 is supposed to codify the Southern Pacific Bryson case, and its language is pretty much verbatim the language of a portion of Rule 26. However, it stops short of adding a further sentence which protects against the disclosure of the mental impressions, conclusions, opinions or legal theories of an attorney or other representative of a party concerning the litigation. I didn't gather there was any particular reason why that wasn't in there. And I think I'd like to ask Dennis just to prepare an amendment that would add that back to consideration by the committee. Further requests for amendments? Section 3, Section 4, Section 5, Section 6.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cronemeyer.
It is true here that Section 4 duplicates a section already found in 2257. Protective order, with respect to protective order.
Yes, and that's a hedge right now against the possibility one of the bills won't pass and another one will. And in fact, we're going to have an amendment that would add that to 2258, just to be safe. I would assume if all three bills were to pass the legislature, that the codifier would...
Is the language the same in every one of them? I'm not
yes,
conforming.
It is. Section 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I'd reiterate that if any of you, on further consideration of bills before the next work session, decide there are further amendments you'd like prepared for committee consideration, just contact Dennis and make the request.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite sure which bill is approved. I'm going to refer to now, but I think there was comment from one of the practicing attorneys about provision for attorney's fees in some of these situations. If the one attorney resists something that is later shown that he didn't have a reasonable ground for resisting, then he has to pay for the fact that the other party had to bring him into court, something along that line.
Well, that's the request for admission, Bill. That's 2258.
Right. But that was, I just want to raise that as I thought there was some issue that some of the members of the committee were interested in.
Well,
I thought it was more than one thing.
That was Cooney's concern, I think, on 2258. Subsection 5 of Section 2, and he wanted some language that would narrow the situation in which that payment could be required to, well, I just wrote bad faith denial in the margin. He wanted some language of that sort. No, but you're not really... you don't really have a comparable situation in your article. There is no cost of proof or a matter type of provision. If you would like to prepare an amendment of that sort, you can consider it.
I'd like to
take a look at it. Further comments on 2259? Okay, 2260.
Let
me take his comments first. Go ahead. Yes.
I lost try to kill him. I don't go to the chair.
One of those are figures, right?
House Bill 2260. Mr. Chairman, this bill was heard on the 7th of February. The bill would eliminate the jury determination of damages when a default judgment is taken. It would amend ORS 18.080. Technically speaking, we heard yesterday that in a default, by not answering, the defendant admits every allegation, including the allegation of damages. And so the argument was, technically speaking, there's no reason for a jury determination of damages. And the objective of this bill is to remedy that situation.
Discussion on the bill, a motion, Representative Lombard.
Did you accept it, Representative Hugis?
Well, I will accept it for purposes of discussion. Representative Hugis moves the bill to the floor with a due pass.
Yeah, I would oppose it for this reason. That getting my little informal survey. That I contacted, so they didn't like it. I think the statement, I forget who was carrying it, I just heard testified on it yesterday, and I my one note about his testimony was there really wasn't a strong feeling on the part of the committee for that measure. It is not true that in a default case the defendant admits even including the allegation of damages, because my recollection is that where the damages are seeking money damages only, and it's ascertainable, the clerk may enter the judgment, but where you've got unascertained damages, general damages, and I raised a question yesterday about punitive damages, but then you must make a hearing and put on evidence before the court, to make the determination. Right now, it is discretionary with the court, whether the court itself is going to make that determination, whether the court is going to make an order of reference, or whether the court is going to call the jury. I see no real harm in leaving that discretion with the court to impanel a jury, if it so desires, and feels it's that kind of case that warrants.
I think it's discretionary unless, in a case for unliquidated damages, any party demands a jury. I read the statute that demanded that the court must impanel a jury. I'm not rebutting the main thrust of what you're saying.
Yeah, I know you're right.
Further discussion on the motion? Representative Gardner?
Just a point that I'd like to ask Representative Lombard. I think I probably agree with you on this bill, but how many people did you call? Can you tell me, like five or six?
Well, I talked at length with two of them, and I talked to two other people. And I've got a list. I've still got some other people that I'm going to call further on these.
Further discussion on the motion?
I think the other side of it is if someone came in today with a bill which would permit jury trials after a default, what would be the committee's attitude? Because that's really what we're being asked to do is continue again affirm the policy behind it. And in light of Ted's expressing interest in judicial administration and work in the court system, in light of the policy of having people given notice of trial and then if they fail to respond, having the matter come to rest, I wonder if such a bill was proposed today, we would grant a jury trial, how would we vote on it? If we were asked today to adopt the bill to grant a jury trial to a party and assume a default, what would be your reaction? Thank you. I don't know if I'd be wrong, but I think most of you would vote against it. That's what I want to be asked
publicly. What was the rationale of allowing a jury trial on the issue of unlimited damages? What was the rationale behind that?
Was your policy initial?
The statute.
I think it goes back before our time, or I don't think anybody alluded to the history of this, but explain it if anybody knew.
I guess I'd like to know what changed. It was a bad policy decision years ago.
Well, it may have been an assessment of fairness, some sense of fairness that will foreclose contest on liability, but as far as how much money will actually be exacted, we'll continue the right to a determination of that question by peers.
But if he doesn't foreclose it, in the sense that a judge is still making the kind of determination the jury would go to. No, just trying to think of that old equitable maxim that equity does not come to the aid of those who sit on their rights, whatever. The maxim doesn't matter, the point does. I don't think there's any reason to have a jury there. If you're going to waive your rights, that's one of the things that's a consequence.
Representative Kielengowski.
David, I see a distinction between the court entering an order of default and then just assessing the damages in the chambers, then having to go into the courtroom and put some order of proof on to prove your unliquidated damages. Now, as I understand it, that would be eliminated. There would be no requirement that the court conduct
a hearing. No, the court would still make a hearing. This is that the defense cannot demand a jury trial.
The court may hear the proof itself or make an order of reference. It sounds to me you're not waiving the court hearing. It's simply the question of whether you have a jury there or the judge does himself.
It's trial by judge only rather than by court in every case. Representative Gardner.
Two comments. One, I don't think that this comes into play very often. Probably the number of times in the last couple of years we count on fingers in one hand. secondly, I think that there's just from a practice and attorney's point, there's something to be said for not just changing something to be changing it. I mean, you know, you learn the law, and we're down here as a judiciary committee changing all these little things here and there, and unless there's some great policy reason behind it, there's some great savings that's going to be realized. I can't see why we should necessarily change the law.
Representative Gardner obviously regards the fact that we table as many bills as we sent out as a mark in favor of the committee. Representative Longmark.
Yeah, I would just second what Mark has said. I guess I put it in other terms. I just didn't feel that the bar made a compelling argument for doing away with it yesterday. In fact, I don't recall any good reason for doing away with it. There was no statement by the representative of the bar that this was creating a problem, that it was creating a backlog, or anything of the sort. In fact, I kind of got the impression that it was seldom used, if ever. So I just didn't feel it was a compelling reason to do away with it.
Further discussion on the motion to report the bill with the due pass recommendation. Clerk Colt.
One last comment. I'll make it short. There might even be a situation where some attorney could screw up and allow a default.
Wait.
No, and allow a default to be entered. And at that point in time, I would rather, if I was that attorney, or that, better yet, that client, I would rather have a jury determine the assessment of damages than the judge.
Further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Blumenauer.
Aye.
Representative Bugis.
Aye.
Representative Cronmark.
Aye.
Representative Kulin-Vasquez.
No.
Representative Lombard.
No.
Representative Richards.
No.
Representative Rutherford.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
No.
Representative Myers.
No. Defeated. For the motions, Representative Gardner.
Move to table House Bill 2260.
Representative Gardner moves to table House Bill 2260. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Blumenauer.
Aye.
Representative Bugis.
Aye.
Representative Cronmeyer.
Aye.
Representative Kulin-Vasquez.
Aye.
Representative Lombard.
Aye.
Representative Richards.
Aye.
Representative Rutherford.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Aye.
Chairman Meyer.
Aye. Table. Okay. Two more items of business and we'll adjourn. First is the trip to the penitentiary for the lifers. Trip to the penitentiary for the lifers. Committee members were asked to check their calendars. Date proposed 15th and the 22nd of February. How many are in favor of the 22nd?
Washington first day.
For holiday.
15th?
Penitentiary
open on the holiday. Closed all the time.
It's open, but nobody's there. Everybody's been let out to go home. Okay, 22nd.
In the afternoon.
Does it require a motion?
I thought you meant about the holidays and the inmates. I thought you meant
that's the evening meeting, 7 to 9. Show up at 6:45.
The first bill, corrections bill out of your Get Tough Judiciary Committee will be the at-home holiday for all the inmates and all
that. What time are you going to send us some?
We'll get a memo to you. Now, the other thing, as I mentioned, is that the club would like some preliminary statement from the committee as to what it is the committee would like to know. So in advance of that meeting, we'll separate some time on one of our agendas of the full committee, perhaps our next work session, spend a little time talking about it. I'd like the members to be thinking about that so we could submit an outline to the club. Representative.
I just wanted to comment and thank Dennis very much for the notes. They helped an awful lot.
Yeah,
very
I think
good.
The session today went very well. Dennis has been a good guy. And I apologize to the committee for chairs having failed to incorporate these little niceties into our hearings earlier. Certainly a defect which I was glad to pointed out to some of our more experienced members. Now, the other thing is two bills for committee introduction by leave of the speaker, since we're past the deadline. One is a bill related to class actions, which was Senate Bill, I think it was 291 in the last section, which came over to the House and died in House committee. I'm not even sure it got a hearing. I'm not advancing the bill on its merits at this point, but it is a bill that a lot of lawyers have asked me to see if the committee would mind introducing just to get it to hearing. And the whole class action area is one legislature I think ought to be taking a look at constantly anyway. It's LC 2286, changes class action provisions, removes pre-litigation notice requirements, eases formation of a class based on common questions of law or fact, removes requirement the court find facts specially and state separately its conclusions in an action pursued by a class based on common questions of fact or law, requires notice to class of any proposed dismissal or compromise rather than only with dismissals or compromises from prejudice, permits rather than requires court to request claim forms class members and then only if the opposing party cannot ascertain the information. It deals limitations on maintenance of class actions for damage to the court does certain acts, allows court to assign cost of notice, permits prevents retention by defending the damages awarded to unidentified plaintiff class members, requires award of attorney's fees to prevailing plaintiff class, provides the award of costs include cost of notices, gives act retroactive effect.
Attorney's full crew bill.
Gives act retroactive effect.
Just introduction. Is there objection to introduction of the committee bill for future consideration?
A question to the chair.
Yes.
Is there any assurance that this bill will be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee?
I am confident it will be. I will clear that with the Speaker before I drop it if the committee would like to have that assurance.
I voted yes. Retroactively contingent on that.
Very well. The committee may take it as an assurance, but I'll get that. Any objection? Second bill comes from Representative Bugas. I'm not sure of its status. I'll have to clarify this with the Speaker. This is not a bill out of a lot of legislative counsel. It's a bill prepared by the District Judges Association relating district court proceedings to those of circuit court, consolidating statutes relating to district court in ORS Chapter 46. The bill obviously has some vigor to be given its origins. I'll have to clarify its status with the Speaker. But is there any objection to its introduction? It has no LC number. I'll give it to you in a moment.
This is
a
PERB unified court bill coming back.
No. Any objection to its authorization upon leave of the Speaker? Introduction upon leave of the Speaker. Okay. Anything else? These, for the information of the committee and the bar, these three discovery bills will be brought on our next work session calendar. What, about a week?
Can we have an update of the prospective calendar?
Let's see. Tomorrow is decriminalization of prostitution.
No, that's next week. No. Let me go get it. I thought that we wanted to share
the hard part. You know, when concerns are you don't recognize that one of the fringe benefits of serving in the legislature and being on the judiciary committee is you being the only one that really knows all the little changes you make.
Yeah,
when you go out after the session, you say,
invaluable asset to your firm.
It is.
You
know,
I can't believe it. A law review article, I think
you just stop practicing law entirely. You just take up, you just sound a little office in the firm, and people come in and ask you, has this been changed? Or you don't take any other cases.
How much
or whatever
about
it?
You can make it as little or as much as you want to. So,
okay, why don't we just pass this out?
I don't know if
that's where we are.
All right, then I'll tell you about that. You're going to read it. Dave, before you take off, I got a question for you. Or comment.
I'd like to before we adjourn, I'd like to draw the committee's attention to one thing. We will start We will start our hearings on the general area of corrections on Monday the 21st by moving into the restitution area initially. I think it will be resolved by the committee later how we're going to deal with any bills that we approve or develop ourselves and approve across the spectrum of different issues that have been raised, whether we'll send out all the bills once as an interrelated package or whether we'll send them out one at a time. As far as I'm concerned, that's a decision the committee itself will probably have some part in. House leadership generally will have some too, I think. But for the moment, we're going to start with restitution. At this point, we have three bills that we've been able to identify. There will be others. I know we introduced one at the Metropolitan Public Defender's request, and I think there maybe was a second one. I'm not sure that's one of these, the DA's bill. So there could be as many as five or six. Hopefully they'll all be out with numbers by this time, but anyway, that's where we'll start in that area. Further business? Adjourned until tomorrow, 1:30, Subcommittee A.
Yeah.